Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new conversation about software engineering. This is Joy Clark, and today on the CASE podcast, I'm going to be talking to Rich Hickey about Clojure and all of the reasons why Clojure is the way it is. Thank you, Rich, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we've had two episodes on Clojure so far, one with Alex Miller about Clojure and one with David Nolan about ClojureScript. And so we'll link those in the show notes. But in this episode, so for all the listeners who aren't that familiar with Clojure, they can go and look at those. But in this episode, I want to concentrate kind of on the why question. You are the creator of Clojure. So why did you write Clojure?
I wrote Clojure because if I had to continue programming in Java, I wouldn't still be a programmer. Java or C++ or C# or the languages I was using and consulting at the time.
Okay.
So I had become an independent consultant and was still working primarily in C++, but got to do some work in Common Lisp and realized how I'd been wasting my time for over a decade and sort of got the bug to figure out a way to use a language like that professionally and through many paths that eventually led to taking a sabbatical and writing Clojure.
Okay. So what problems was it designed to solve? Why is it designed the way it is?
It's fundamentally designed to reduce the complexity in programming. I think programming is far too complex, and there are a bunch of things that make it so. The primary one, so the domains are complex, and there's no way to get around some of that. But we have a lot of self-inflicted complexity, in particular in languages that aren't functional. The number one source of complexity is the use of state. So I knew I wanted to write a language that de-emphasized programming with, you know, places, as I like to say, memory locations, and emphasized programming with values like other functional languages. And then there are other aspects of complexity that come into programming with any of these more commonly used statically typed languages, which have to do with the complexity in the language space. You know, I think there's a lot of just very idiosyncratic stuff in programming languages that is unnecessary. And not only is it unnecessary and, you know, causing complexity in terms of taking up your mental space to understand it and apply it, but it also has other costs in terms of yielding programs that are larger, more full of more concretions, less general, and more brittle.
So we've had some episodes about Clojure running on the JVM and on JavaScript. What other platforms does it run on?
There is a CLR port. I believe that's the only near complete version of Clojure.
Okay. Do you think there's any other platforms that it would be cool to run for it to run on in the future?
I don't think so. You know, obviously linkage to, you know, C is interesting, but I don't think there's as well-defined a library space there as there is for Java and .NET. And that was the main reason to target those.
I heard there's some kind of like Erlang port. Is that a possibility that that would be supported in the future?
Not by me. Okay. I'm happy to see people try things, but I'm completely uninterested in that. I don't know of any phenomenal Erlang libraries I'm dying to use.
Ah, okay. Do you regret putting it on the JVM? That was the main, that's the main Clojure. Because the one people who use it are probably Java programmers or coming from that direction.
That's not actually true. You know, we get as many people coming from Ruby and Python as we do from Java. We get plenty of people from Java. But no, I don't regret it at all. It's probably one of the most important things to it having succeeded. Because when people start with a new language that doesn't have libraries, they wait a long time to get up to the power level they expect by having access to libraries. and Clojure had libraries the first day, the very first, you know, day you had Clojure, you could use any database in in existence because JDBC existed and Clojure could use it. So it's quite critical to the design of Clojure that it be hosted and that it be hosted on a platform like Java. So I don't think that, you know, its interaction or dependence on Java or JavaScript for the Clojure script case is a negative. I think it's a big positive. It does add something to what you'll have to become familiar with in order to be most productive. On the flip side, you can be most productive. That's the point. As a pragmatic point, having access to libraries means you have power.
So Clojure 1.9 was just released. What's new in Clojure 1.9?
So at the language level, it's mostly bug fixes and things like that. But one of the things that we've been working on is something called Spec. And Clojure Spec is a library for doing for expressing, you know, what our program is supposed to do and do they do it. And, you know, like many things that come into Clojure more recently, it is a library. I mean, Clojure is a Lisp as a language, you know, by design, it's supposed to stay small. We shouldn't be modifying the language to accomplish new things. So, but we had some architectural things to do so that Clojure itself could use Spec in its implementation a little bit. And that led to a bunch of work, which is maybe hard to see, but quite important, around how Clojure consumes dependencies and things like that. So that's probably the biggest thing in 1.9 in the language. The other thing that came out with 1.9 is a set of tools. This is the first version of Clojure that actually has like a brew installer. So you can brew install Clojure. And the other thing it has is a runner, which can analyze dependencies and create a class path and actually, you know, procure those dependencies, create a class path and run your program. And this is something that people had gotten from third-party tools, but we never really had a solution for newcomers who wanted to grab Clojure and use libraries on the first day.
So the intention of the installer script is to make it easy to install on your machine, correct?
So there's two aspects. There's the installer, which is just a matter of obtaining Clojure. The more important thing is what you get when you run that installer. And what you get are a set of command line tools that do this dependency-aware invocation of Clojure. So if you want to run anything on the JVM, you have to eventually call Java and provide it with a class path. And Clojure works by just supplying only Clojure on the class path. But when you want to use libraries, they have to be put on the class path, and you have to get them. And the whole getting libraries is a task that people usually rely on something like Maven to do for them. And then class path building is something that, again, people had to go to other tools outside of Clojure like Leiningen or Boot to do that. So, you know, the idea of getting started was get Clojure and get something like Leiningen and Boot and learn all of that. So now you don't have to because the Clojure command line tools themselves can find libraries, download them, and incorporate them in the class path.
So the Leiningen and Boot are like the Maven equivalent in Clojure. So basically, so does the new installer replace that, or is it intended to replace it?
not exactly. I think that, you know, the one of the problems is, you know, what it is. Those things and Maven do a lot. Most of them do allow you to express your dependencies, and they can procure dependencies, and they can form the class path, and they can be a runner and run Clojure with that class path. But they also can build generally and or deploy and make Uber jars and all of that. And that aspect of Maven and similarly in these other tools turns them into kind of large monolithic things. And another big part of what we're trying to do with this dependency stuff is to separate out and decompose that problem and say, this this part that we've delivered is strictly about dependencies and class path generation, and it doesn't do any building or anything like that. So you still might want a tool like that to build your final deployable thing.
Mm-hmm. Is there any ideas in the future about providing something similar for Clojure script, so you can never have to go into NPM hell ever again?
So I think that the problem of dependencies is a big problem. It's one of the unsolved problems right now for programming. And I've been thinking a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And this is on the path towards that. One of the other things that you can do with this new dependency stuff is directly consume code from Git repos by using Git SHAs as your dependency, as opposed to an artifact in a place. Mm-hmm. And it's in addition to that, it can consume Maven still. But the other thing that we did was sort of decompose or decomplect transitive dependency analysis, which most of these tools rely on Maven to do. Mm-hmm. But Maven only understands Maven and only navigates through Maven dependencies. And we now have lifted the transitive dependency analyzer out so that it can traverse through Maven dependencies, but also through Git and through more than one way of representing your dependencies. So whether it's a POM or a project config file or the new format that these tools use, which is called deps.eden.
Mm-hmm.
So this is super important, and it takes us towards where I'd like to see us go, which is a stronger connection between what we're consuming and the source truth of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think a big problem is you grab a library and you really have no idea, no idea what you got. You know, maybe it has a label that says it's 1.2, but you don't know which functions inside it have changed or why. Mm-hmm. And you don't actually know what you're running. And maybe the jar file or artifact, you know, tells you something about the source that was used to produce it, but the process that was used to produce it is often opaque. And any of that could be wrong because there's a lot of human steps involved in producing artifacts. So I'd like to get closer to, you know, because so many people use Git, to get closer to leveraging, you know, some of the features there.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, you know, using SHAs and content-based addressing to talk about things. I had worked on a library called Codec, which we'll have a new version of soon, that sort of extends the Git model down to the function level. So you would have mm-hmm. SHAs for individual functions, and you could have dependencies on functions instead of on artifacts. So a lot of work is happening around that, and some of that has manifested itself in this dependency tool.
Okay. So one of the, I'm thinking about dependencies and what happens when I upgrade my dependencies, like in my Java project. And I get a whole bunch of compiler errors, but in Clojure, they would be runtime errors, right? How do you deal with that? Because Clojure is a dynamic language, so it's not compiled. When you upgrade a library and it's incompatible, like, how does Clojure know what happens then?
Well, there's a lot of presumptions in that question.
There are. There are a lot of presumptions.
So the first thing I would say is what you're talking about are symptoms, right?
Yeah.
The problem is not that, you know, the problems are found later or earlier, or that they manifest themselves as compilation errors or runtime errors, but the fact that your library provider broke your program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I don't think should happen as nearly as often as it does,
mm-hmm.
and is actually quite avoidable. But unfortunately, we still do place-oriented programming in the library space.
Okay.
So you could say that library, you know, foo is a place.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I look at that place, I find a different library. And sure enough, the values are just changing out from under me, and the things I depended upon are no longer true. When a library breaks, it can break in many ways. Some of those may or may not be manifest in types. Others would just be manifest in behavior or missing information or additional requirements, things that you can't express in types, because most of what your program needs to do can't be expressed in the type systems we have today.
Mm-hmm.
It still takes a string and still returns a map of information, but it stopped returning you some of that information, or it started returning other stuff, or it had additional requirements about mm-hmm. the string. You know, the types don't capture that.
So does spec help with that problem of knowing what actually goes into your function and what comes out?
So there are a couple of different problems here. If we stick at the library level, one of the problems is this, you know, breaking things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the problems we have is that we think about change generically as if change was a thing. But there are really two very distinct kinds of change. There are breaking changes, mm-hmm. Where your expectations have been violated. And there are accretions, where there's just some more stuff, where there wasn't stuff before. And in general, accretion is not breaking.
Mm-hmm.
So if I had a library I was using and it had functions A, B, C, and version 1.2 of the library added functions X, Y, Z, my code that used ABC is unaffected by that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take that idea of what accretion means, you can now apply that to things like argument lists or return values.
Mm-hmm.
And you can start talking about what a function either requires or provides.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say I had a function, one of those ABCs that already exists and you're already calling, and I want to enhance it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I require more from you than I used to, I've broken you. Mm-hmm. If I require less from you than I used to, I haven't. On the return value side, if I provide more to you than I used to provide, I haven't broken you. But if I provide less, then I have. If I provide less than what I used to promise. And so there's a real directionality to the contracts of functions mm-hmm. and code. And there are changes you can make in both directions that are compatible with existing consumers, and changes you can make that are not. And when you understand, you know, that you're either adding requirements breaks and removing requirements doesn't, and providing more doesn't break and providing less does break, then you could say all the non-breaking changes are evolution compatible. They allow programs to evolve. They allow them to evolve independently, which are super critical properties for systems to run over a long period of time. And I think that it's a big mistake to say, well, static types allow me to break people and they can figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what you don't want to do.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I would say that if you're going to break someone at all, just don't. And
okay.
Call the function, you know, D or A2,
mm-hmm.
right? And leave A around.
Yeah.
These are the same kinds of strategies that we use at the service level in order to have loosely coupled systems that don't break consumers and allow consumers and servers, clients and servers to independently evolve. And it's just as important in the small. I think that it's, again, a sort of a big problem that we think about change sort of generically, and we think about typing tools as tools to enable breakage.
Okay.
And that makes for brittle programs. And it was certainly my experience before Clojure, working with static type systems, that all the systems were incredibly brittle.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the cost of change just got so high. You know, every system eventually got thrown away because the cost of change became too great.
Mm-hmm. So in these functions, is it usually like you would take a map and return a map? Because I can imagine, like, even if I were to change a function and say, oh, I need something else, if I change the arity of the function, that's also breakage. I mean, I could put another function next to it or change, like, make it a var arg function. But essentially, so, like, every time I need something new, I guess I personally would go for creating functions with, like, a couple of arguments as opposed to, like, putting everything in a map. but maybe that's not the best way to do it.
So it ends up being the case, and this directly connects to Speckin, to your question from before. You know, mm-hmm. is Speckin this space trying to, you know, contend with these challenges of allowing you to talk about what your program does and determine that it works and allow you to communicate to consumers about your, you know, contracts. And it does, in fact. And the way it does is it allows you to talk about either function signatures or data structures using one of two logics. One, it would be set logic around maps and map keys. And the other would be regular expressions for things that are sequential, like function argument lists are an example of a sequential contract. And it ends up in both spaces, those ideas I talked about before about requiring less or providing more, both apply. If you think about a set of keys, if you're accepting that as an argument, then to require more keys would be breaking, but to require fewer keys would not. Mm-hmm. If you're returning maps, then to return more would be non-breaking, and to return less, at least about the things you said promised you would return, would be breaking. So the same ideas apply. So you can talk about maps, and you can, we're still working on the language to make it precise to talk about providing and requiring certain keys. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, in the regular expression space, there's also a notion of regular expression compatibility, which is to say there's logic behind regular expressions that allows you to say that this regular expression can accept all things this other one could, but maybe some additional things. And you could leverage that logic to actually make, you know, non-breaking changes to function arity. For instance, if you could take two arguments before and now you could take two or three, you haven't broken anyone as long as you haven't changed the meaning of what it means to pass two.
Okay.
You've just enabled people to be able to pass three. And I think it's essential for people to start understanding what it means to provide or require and to look at their changes in that light. It's certainly one of the long-term objectives that for spec, we will take the expressions you make in spec about providing and requiring and turn that into a test for change to say, you know, if I want to modify this spec and it's a spec about requiring, is it compatible or is it breaking? And if it's breaking, you know, we won't allow it. And on the same thing, flipped around on the return side.
So what does spec look like?
So spec is a predicative language about data. Mm-hmm. So much in Clojure is data. We express all of our information as generic data. We write code as data structures. We use data structures as domain-specific languages for configuration or HTML and pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to say, to have an open system that is not limited to any particular logic or static verifiability, but to say any predicates you want, you can write regular Clojure code, and you can basically say what you consider to be required to be true of a data structure. Mm-hmm. And you do that either in the small with, you know, assertions about, the types of atomic things like numbers or Booleans. And then in the large, you use one of these other two techniques talking about either maps and the sets of keys associated with maps or with regular expressions for sequences. And most of the sequences, you know, people tend not to use sequential things in like wire protocols and service contracts because they're terrible. they're very brittle. But we do, you know, still use sequentiality in function signatures. So it's necessary for that. And then, so you write these expressions and they're just, it's just like a little domain-specific language. But it's independent of the Clojure code. You can write specs for things that you wrote or things that other people wrote and they haven't spec'd themselves. If you're trying to understand a library, you can write some spec expressions about it and see if they are if they hold. And the first job of spec given one of these specs is to do validation, which is what you would expect. You know, I have this predicate about this data structure. You know, is it true of this particular value? But spec does a lot more because it also does generative test. It does generation, so it can generate data that satisfies the predicate. So you can say, you know, I have this function, and I said it returns this shape. And you can say, exercise this spec, and it will generate a bunch of those shapes. And that's the underpinnings of the next feature, which is that spec supports generative testing, you know, quick check style testing. So if you spec, you know, some or all of your code, and it's not a type system. It's not necessary for it to be complete or for there to be types everywhere. It's not like types. It's really predicates. But for whatever predicates you've defined on functions, spec can automatically generate data to test those functions, you know, taking it through a random space and validate that the functions work, that they are returning what they say they will. And remember, these are not, these are arbitrary predicates. So the predicates of what you return can include what you put in as part of the argument. So you actually can spec the behavior of a function as opposed to just it has, you know, its return value has some particular shape. You can, for instance, make sure that, you know, if you were passed a collection coming in, every member of that collection coming in is present in the collection going out.
Okay.
And various other value things like that. So the idea behind the testing is that these are not, these validations and these tests are not for production runtime.
Okay.
All the tools are set up to allow you to do this work prior to release, that it's part of the development time and testing phase of development. And all the checks and everything are turned off at runtime. You can still use spec if you want to be a, you know, gatekeeper on a the end of a wire, for instance, because you can use spec to define specs for wire protocols and communications protocols. And so that's something you might want to leave in production. But otherwise, there's no overhead associated with using spec.
So at runtime, there's the assumption that everything, like a production runtime, you assume that you've done so much generative testing that it must be, like, the functions must be the correct specification, so we don't have to do the same checks during runtime at production.
Well, I mean, you can make whatever decisions you make ordinarily. But it's no different from static systems. They have tests, too, and they can either run those tests all the time or just before they ship. But, you know, the what you can express with spec is way more than you can express with a type system.
Is it sufficient? Because I came from a background of doing a little bit of like formal formal validation and specifications over like secure safety critical systems. Would spec be helpful in that context? Because that's one area that I personally find like a type system or some kind of proof, like I want to have a proof that my program actually does what it says it's going to do, because someone's life is on the line. But would spec be?
I consider that pretty much hyperbole. So let's take the function reverse.
Yeah.
Okay. So in Haskell, reverse has a type of list of A to list of A. If that type checks, do you know that that works?
No.
No. And that's true of most of your statically typed software. Most of what's important about what they do is not captured by the type systems because they are not semantic in the first place. They're mostly just mechanical. And the logics they have are pretty weak. I think if I had a safety critical system, I'd be looking outside of a type system because they're so anemic to a stronger a formal verification system that is outside of the program. You know, if you want to write an algorithm to make sure you were doing spin locks correctly or distributed transactions correctly. People do use proof systems for that, but they don't use the ones built into programming languages. They use much more powerful ones.
That is true.
So I'm in favor of that. I'm mostly advocating that, like spec, it be a la carte.
Yeah, okay. You also created Datomic.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about just what that is and what its current state is?
Sure. So Datomic is, you know, somewhat pointed at the same problems that Clojure is, right? Mm-hmm. Things are too complicated and we're doing place-oriented programming. And the other big place you have left once you switch to a functional programming language is your database. So, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can use Clojure or Scala or Haskell. And then, you know, this database ruins everything for you because it is a place and most databases update in place. Mm-hmm. So there's all the complexity associated with that there is with using places, you know, in memory. What Datomic endeavors to do is to say, let's stop doing that. We have a lot more storage space than we ever did. And we have enough that we could take a functional approach to storing our data. And, I think people already realize this. People are certainly logging everything and keeping everything and going append only. The real value proposition of Datomic is to both, again, sort of only accrete information, not change it in place, but also provide the logical support for accessing that. And in particular, for allowing you to use the database at a point in time as if it were a value in your program. Mm-hmm. That is the big trick of Datomic.
Okay.
When you do that, a lot of things that were complex become straightforward, just like when you move away from mutable variables to values, you're able to say, well, you know, of course I can perform three distinct operations with this value and not worry about the consistency of their results because the value might have changed. That is a hard thing with update in place databases. You do three queries, and you know, if stuff happened in between, then the basis for the queries, it was different and their results can't be correlated. Mm-hmm. With Datomic, even if things have accreted in between your three operations, you could treat the database as a value and perform three operations and know you get results that are consistent between them. Okay. So that's the idea behind Datomic, and the state of it is we're right on the verge of shipping the cloud version of Datomic. So okay. it had been software that you run on your own behalf with a traditional install. And now we will have an offering in Amazon's AWS Marketplace for getting Datomic that way. You'll have the ability to get a Datomic instance up for, you know, around $1 a day to get started and explore it. And then we have different, you know, production levels of instances and deployments. So we're hopeful that will make it a lot more accessible and certainly help people program for the cloud. I think, you know, again, we see in that space a lot of complexity as people take software that was written for a stable network, you know, with machines you could go and, you know, put stickers on with pet names and kick and, you know, unplug and plug back in and replace the hard drives in to this more ephemeral world of the cloud. And as you move data center software up to the cloud, you struggle with a lot of things. Datomic Cloud was written for that environment. It's a lot more, you know, it's completely tuned for working with Amazon's logging and metric systems and encryption systems and things like that. So we're hopeful that we'll make, Clojure a really good language for doing cloud development because you'll have this tool that's compatible with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, awesome. I'll have to check that out. In your opinion, is there a benefit to opinionated approach to program architecture? I know, like, I have some people who talk to me about closure and they're coming from like the Rails world or like they use Spring Boot and Java and they're like, how do I write a web application in closure? And I'm like, well, you can use all these different libraries and they compose together, but you can kind of like pick and choose. And I don't know, I think it's one of the reasons it's kind of difficult. Well, it's not that difficult, but it's a reason that makes it more difficult to get started because there's just so many options. So is there a benefit to like having a standard stack? We can say this is what you should use.
Well, some parts of that question are social.
Yes.
I can't really speak to. I think certainly when somebody figures out how to do web development, they should encode it in a framework.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that that's a solved problem.
Okay.
And I think until it is a solved problem, opinions are very much opinions and therefore, you know, you're at risk adopting a set of opinions that may not be an answer.
Okay.
I've certainly let the community, you know, find its own way in this area. I think we have some very talented people doing really good work, including David Nolan. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really important to be able to say, I don't know. I don't know yet.
Okay.
I'm not going to go code up this big thing because, you know, some of the things that you're talking about as being, you know, standard, they also have a bunch of known shortcomings. So while socially it's straightforward to say everybody's doing X, mm-hmm. You may not like doing X after you've done it for a while and found all the problems.
Mm-hmm. It kind of leads into my next question is what other problems do you think there are left to solve?
I certainly think this dependency problem and program evolution is a big, you know, question.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly build programs out of parts, and now we build, you know, systems out of programs. And so the whole idea of, you know, programming and, you know, in the old days, a program was completely self-sufficient, almost used no libraries, was written by one person, ran on one processor, and knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now a program is just a dot in a big picture of the system. And there are many programs, maybe more than one programming language. There's a database or more than one database. There are wires mm-hmm. and wire protocols and things like that. And I think that when you think about that kind of a system, you end up with a bunch of pressures and concerns around things like what I was talking about before. What are your promises? What do you require? What do you provide? How do you talk mm-hmm. about them in a way that supports evolution? Because it's simply insufficient to say, today, we know the type of everything, and we've encoded it all, and we've all agreed, and we've all recompiled, and it all works perfectly. And then, you know, tomorrow, if anything changes, everybody needs to stop and rebuild. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. I mean, that's not the way the internet was built, and it's just not the way bigger systems work. And I think we're suffering in the small from from not paying attention to those same concerns. Like you said, you know, feeling like it's a regular thing to have a library break you. And thank goodness your type system helps you figure out some portion of how you got broken, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That shouldn't be happening. And so I think that's a big area. To the extent that we had relied on our languages as sort of tools for encoding our understanding of the problems we're trying to solve, that's obviously inadequate now because the programs are always sub-problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more important to talk, like it's way more important for an architect to be talking about the schema of their database and the wire protocols than it is about, you know, types in any programming language. It doesn't yeah. matter which. So, you know, when do you start talking about that stuff? How do you talk about it? What's nice about something like spec is it's just as good at talking about wire protocols and datomic mm-hmm. schemas as it is about closure.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that really has nothing to do with closure. And yeah. it's things like that, I think, that's an area for growth. We need more of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's actually going to be solved? I mean, I'm just thinking, like, is that, I don't, I, maybe I'm just too much of a pessimist. Like, I guess like maybe I'm just always expect that someone will go and break the library at some point in the future. And it's all futile. And
well, you know, I think it's hard, right? Because until you're able to disentangle breaking change from compatible change, you sort of can only shrug at this problem. But if we had more tools that could say, no, 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 this change is a breaking change and this change is a compatible change, then it wouldn't just be this black box of change.
Yeah.
Similarly, if you had more insight into the granularity of changes in a library as opposed to just knowing this giant artifact with all its dependencies move from, you know, 1.2 to 1.3. And, you know, just who knows what's different to actually know. And again, things like spec and specs and things like codec that give you more insight to dependencies that finer granularity will at least allow you to start having conversations with people about what they're doing and what you're doing and what the promises actually are. But a big part of it is certainly social. But I think one of the things that's been nice about Clojure is, because you talked about opinionated, and I think you meant more in the area of like framework. I think certainly Clojure is opinionated in its design and sort of what it makes idiomatic and what it makes hard even. And I think that that does help people make decisions. At least they have, one, an example, and two, hopefully reusable tools they can use to emulate the example. When you have more of that, I think you make it easier for people to do the right thing. And I guess that would be another sort of objective of Clojure, would be to help make it easier for people to do the right thing.
Yeah. But that can't be solved like by one programming language. Because there probably will not be like a homogeneous programming environment. Like one system is written only in this language. I mean, I don't think Java is going anywhere anytime soon. There will probably be people writing Java applications that we have to take into account in some way or shape.
Right. So where programs meet each other are on wire protocols, where, you know, we're not using Java serialization over wires. So what are we saying there? What are we saying about that stuff? And, you know, people are trying things. I think a lot of what they're trying has a lot of the shortcomings of static typing in terms of not being evolution oriented. But I do think you'll see more work on that. Certainly other things that we've done in the Clojure dev space have been around that, defining something like Eden and things like Transit, which are wire protocols, is part of the job. It's not about Clojure the language. It's about tools for communicating. Spec will be something that can work on wire protocols. May be other things.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to ask if Eden is used in other programming languages besides Clojure.
So Eden is not, for reasonable reasons. I think that if you're going to solve the protocol problem, you've got to be able to reach the browser. And that's why we worked on Transit. And Transit is actually quite good at communicating between languages and to the browser. So the performance of Transit to the browser. Transit is just another way to encode sort of the same set of data structures. So Eden can encode the data structures of Clojure, which I consider to sort of just be the basic data structures. You know, you have some atomic types like integers and floating point numbers and Booleans and strings. And then you have maps and sets and vectors and lists. So Eden can encode all those things. Transit can encode those same things. It also, like Eden, is extensible in that you could define new things in terms of the things that are built in. So if you want to have a record type or something like that, you could define that. But what it has over Eden is sort of a character format, and Transit has encodings, in particular, directly to JSON.
Oh, okay.
But it can be faster to transfer stuff through Transit over JSON than it can to transfer JSON sometimes to the browser, because Transit incorporates things like redundancy, compression, and stuff like that. So that's an effective thing, and I know people are using it from different languages.
Okay.
So that's not to say like it's as popular as protocol buffers or something like that, but I do think this is the area, this is the space. Wire protocols, and also protocols or specifications for services. How do you talk about what your service expects, what it requires, what it provides in a way that is compatible with evolution?
Yeah, I'd like to have that.
Yeah.
I love the, oh, we changed the format of the date string, so now my program broke. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think that, you know, we're having a conversation right now about what is breaking change or not.
Yeah.
10 years ago, the conversations we were having about functional versus, you know, mutation were seemed as novel. And now, you know, it's quite common. I think that even in languages that are not primarily functional, the emphasis on a functional approach is widespread. And we've certainly seen a lot of the closure ideas incorporated in the JavaScript community. And that's not just because David Nolan is so charismatic, but because they work. So I think that, you know, I'm more hopeful. I can't solve the social problems, but I think we can make tools and make examples that make, again, doing the right thing more straightforward.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because I started programming maybe 7-8 years ago, and I was kind of brainwashed into believing that immutability was the only correct way, like from very, very early on. And so I don't understand like object orientation really. And I always try to like I have to program in Java, and people are like sending me things, and I'm like, why do you do it like that? I don't understand. You could just make it public, like final, like, you know, it doesn't have to change. So I just don't know. I don't understand object orientation. That was more of a comment. That wasn't a question.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, you know, that's the thing. I think as long as people are writing functional languages and writing in functional languages, they will serve as examples, and some younger programmers will never have seen something else and, you know, won't have to unlearn a bunch of bad habits.
Yeah. Unless I art. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I think it's interesting because I don't know anything else. And so I'm like sometimes people ask me like why I like functional programming so much. And I'm like, well, you know, it just feels right. Like I don't have a good reason. I can't like argue it from the perspective of someone who came like from object orientation. And apparently there's a whole bunch of problems with that. And I'm just usually say, oh, I like it. don't really know. I can't argue the point as well as some, maybe, for that reason.
It's worth learning enough about the other to argue the point objectively, so it isn't just a preference thing.
That's what I think. I would like to do that. I mean, I don't want to just choose something because everyone's doing it, kind of. I feel like functional programming is a trend now, and everyone's jumping on the functional programming bandwagon. But I would like to have a reason behind that, not just because everyone else is doing it.
Functional programs are simpler for the, you know, the deep definition of simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've challenged some of the conventional ideas of programming, like the reliance on mutable data and changing data in place, but also practices like agile software development and the obsession with testing. What's your view about the ideal way an efficient team of developers should go about programming?
They should spend a lot of time thinking about what problem they're trying to solve before they do anything. That is the number one problem in programming. The time is not spent and people flounder around. If you did that, you could probably do well with almost any set of tools. So, you know, I don't make tools sort of preeminent in programming success.
Yeah.
I think if you have, you know, if you really are good problem solvers and are focused on the problem, and, you know, decomposing the problem and problems, you're gonna do well. I don't think that people should write a lot of tests. Mm-hmm. I think people should run a lot of tests. We don't have better technology than testing for determining that our software does what it's supposed to do from a real world requirements perspective, what it's supposed to do. So we need to be able to say what it's supposed to do and then hopefully get some technology helping us to determine that. And the best technology right now for that are things like Quick Check, that kind of generative testing. So instead of writing a test that is an example of one successful execution, what you should write are properties or specs in the case of spec, and let the computer, you know, write a million tests for you and run them. So I'm a big proponent of testing. I'm not a big proponent of test writing. And, you know, the way people test, I think, is pretty terrible until you adopt generative testing and property-based testing and specification-driven testing, where there's a tremendous amount of power. So I think you want to adopt that. That would be my next piece of advice. Certainly, you want to be doing functional programming primarily. Not that you can, you know, avoid doing anything else at all times, but that should be the default for sure. And I think you should be working in a language that makes those things idiomatic, so that you're not fighting against a different paradigm. So while people can do object-oriented Java or JavaScript, I think it's always, I'm sorry, do functional style Java or JavaScript. It's never going to be idiomatic. It's always going to be hard. It's always going to look awkward, feel awkward, confuse your coworkers. So these languages have a lot to offer.
Is there any signs that you can, like, if you're solving the wrong problem, how do you figure that out with it in enough time that you can kind of change and solve the right one instead? Because testing doesn't prove that I'm solving the right problem. It proves that what I did, like what the code that I wrote, does what I think it should write, which does what I think it should do. Which is good, but if I'm solving the wrong problem, there's a it's all wrong.
So you know, there are two things, right? There could be just the wrong problem in general, or you haven't decomposed the problem well. And I don't know of any magic recipes. You're outside of technology at that point. I think you've got to. I mean, it's certainly, it's funny because I think programmers, especially young programmers, they use far too much of their brain power on programming stuff, you know, learning the idiosyncrasies of a programming language, learning some really, you know, arcane type system stuff, or, you know, tons of details about some gigantic JavaScript, you know, UI library du jour, and not nearly as much time on the domains in which they operate. And it's sort of one of the coolest things about programming is, you know, I tell this to people who want to take up computer science or whatever, is that you really get, you really get two specialties or more. You get to learn about computer science and programming and things like that, but you also always are applying it in a domain. And unless you're a compiler writer or a theorem mm-hmm. prover writer, you're going to have some other domain. You might be doing medical imaging stuff or music scheduling or, writing an election system or a climate analysis thing or, e-commerce. And these are big, fascinating domains with lots of interesting aspects. Mm-hmm. I think a good programmer is highly engaged with the domain side of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd rather see people spend a lot more time there. And that helps you with the, am I solving the right problem?
Okay.
How much of your brain time are you spending there? Did you spend 10 minutes with somebody in the domain and then, you think you're just smart enough to go run off and code it up? Or maybe you took everything they said, at face value and never questioned it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of times users in a domain say they need X and, a good programmer or a good systems analyst was the old time name for it, would know how to turn that into a conversation where you would take a step back from saying, all right, I know you're presuming you need this answer,
mm-hmm.
But let's roll back a little bit more towards your problem. And maybe if I understand your problem better, we'll have more than one possible answer, and those answers will have different trade-offs or different characteristics. And
mm-hmm.
That's where the work is. That's certainly where I spend most of my time. Mm-hmm. I'd rather chew on a problem for 10 days out of 2 weeks and code for the other four than to agilely rewrite it six times in 4 weeks. In 4 weeks, and then still have it be wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any technical things that are worth looking into? I feel like a lot of times the younger programmers come and they're like, oh, I have lots of great ideas, and they do exactly the same errors as the people who were learning to program 15 years ahead of time. And there's some great ideas from the 70s and 80s, but I never know if I have, I guess my question is, I have a lot of time ahead of me, personally. And I know I have a lot of brain time ahead of me, which I'm looking forward to, but I also would, if you could give some tips about what direction I should use my brain energy on, that'd be good.
Well, I think, people talk about reading papers and whatever, but I certainly would point anyone who wants to learn more about programming to the papers from the old days of computer science,
mm-hmm.
From the days of, Lisp and Smalltalk, when the people who were writing computer science papers were also writing systems.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to write, logic systems or reasoning systems or chess playing systems or user interfaces or the first databases. The earlier computer science papers, not all of them, but a lot of them from those communities especially, are very special in that you've got the work of people who are, obviously they're still researchers and they're still doing theoretical stuff, but the level of practice
mm-hmm.
That was present there is quite evidently different than at least what gets published today, which is just math.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of system stuff that's really fascinating, like reading about self and what they were doing to try to optimize dispatch. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool.
Do you know them off the top of your head? Could you name some papers to look into?
You can find that. You can find the self paper.
Self paper.
Self is the name of programming language, and there's a good paper probably in the history of programming languages. It's sort of a big summary of the whole project, but all those papers, the Smalltalk papers and the Common Lisp papers and the Lisp and Scheme papers are all really good.
Okay. Well, I will try to look for them and put them in the show notes for any listeners. Well, thank you so much for your time. I had a great time talking to you.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you for creating closure.
You're welcome.
Okay. So to all our listeners, until next time.